As you know, I've been working with Leon over 15 years, so I have a large spectrum of image analysis methods, because right now I have a system that obviously hasn't solved the problem. So I'm going to give you examples of what the system is about and what the challenges we faced and we're still facing. And it's good that we haven't solved the problem, so there's many more years for us and everybody else. And I think afterwards you're going to hear a lot of detailed talks on each of the subjects I'm going to touch here. So, so in terms of background, of course I'm going to talk about MR tagging, because that's primarily the area I worked on, even though the methods we've been describing, some of them are more general. Okay. So what we're trying to do basically is we're trying to develop software that will allow, if you want, radiologists and cardiologists to be able to analyze and find correlations that they cannot by looking at 2D images. Okay, now the images we're facing with is this basically tagging, these tagging images, and some disease started looking at this ischemia, arrhythmia, hypertrophy, again, from MR tagging methods. So now I'll go more into details about tagging as we go along. So so what we have is we have these images, as you see, that a lot of people have talked before, Leon and many others. And what the challenge we're facing is how, from an image like this, you can segment the boundaries automatically. The left ventricle, the right ventricle, inside, as you know, here is the blood pool. And then you know the images are not nice. We can always produce very nice looking images, right? So you have this fuzziness. You have fuzziness of the boundaries, fuzziness of the tagging lines because they fade. So how do you deal with these problems? So as you know about tagging, it's a set of equally spaced parallel planes of grids, initially, of course, saturated by magnetization within the myocardium. They're generated with methods like Leon and others have developed. And the image planes are perpendicular, as you see over there, with respect, the image planes are perpendicular to the tagging lines initially. The tagging lines appear as parallel dark strips in MRI, like this, like in this case. Okay, but they're really seeds, okay, the dimensional seeds. So what we're seeing is 2D, of course, and this is what basically we're seeing. Now, what notice that they fade because this magnetization over a few milliseconds, lasts for a few milliseconds, then dies. So you can only analyze the tagging lines for as long as they exist, obviously. And then what you can do, we've done this in the past, you can cascade. If you're doing a model-based approach, you can basically superimpose new set of tagging lines to cover the whole cycle. Okay? So that's the problem, basically. This is the movies we're having. We want to segment the whole boundary of the heart. The LV here, the walls, the inner, the outer, and the RV. And you notice that the LV is simpler because it has thicker walls, so you can get more tagging lines, while the RV is a lot thinner, so you see a lot less tagging lines. So all these are issues because, you know, it all depends how long the patient has to be in the market. And I've been a subject, it takes time. So that's why the software has to be fast, and of course reliable when you don't get very nice. So the tasks that I'm going to outline this talk, there's a lot of tasks here we've been working, is the first is even though we didn't start with it this way, we started by assuming there was segmentation and then modeling the 3D. I mean, the real system we're having now is that you have low-level image processing using Gabor filters. I'll tell you why we're using Gabor filters. Then we have deformed modes and learning methods. I'm going to show you two different methods to do segmentation of the boundaries that have pros and cons. So as I'm giving all this to you as examples of what we've done and the challenges we're facing and what we faced and are still facing, so then I think we'll motivate you in terms of what the problems are. Of course, the construction of the geometry, shape and motion analysis of the heart, final methods we've done since 94, 95, and stochastic methods of modeling the stress-strain relationship. Again, the problem is we can see the strains, we don't know the stresses. But you have experiments where you have some idea. So the question is, how do you tune using expectation maximization methods? We have basically the stress-strain relation for a patient specific. Again, the focus of all this is patient-specific. We don't do so much work on animals. So that's why I said these methods are very challenging, because you have to deal with humans. And if they're going to be ever become clinical, they have to be obviously robust and reliable. And of course, I'll just show you some first results about modeling the intracavity blood flow. I mean, we started back in Mika in 98. We had the first patient-specific. Assuming you knew the boundary motion, how do you simulate the blood flow? But now, since we're getting better results at the boundaries, we're trying to do better simulations of the flow. So, but I'll only show you a slide. All right. So, the tagline instruction. So, this is the image you have, and you want to extract the tagging lines. Now, the tagging lines, initially, they're equally spaced, but they're not equally spaced over time, because the heart deforms. So the spacing changes. So the Fourier domain of the tag MR image, is there are relatively isolated peaks, right? That's what you see if you do the Fourier transform. And the first harmonic peaks represent the final timelines. I mean, Jerry is going to talk a lot about this in more detail. But so intuitively, a bandpass filtering could be used to capture the tag line part, right? So this is a fast way of doing this. Now, why we've been using Gabor filters? Primarily because, as I said, initially the timelines are equal space, but then they change, right? And they change the spacing and the orientation. So we want to get a very detailed analysis of the timelines, simply because afterwards we want to do reconstruction. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Gabor, in case you haven't heard. But so it's a Gaussian-shaped bandpass filter. Again, the spatial domain, the Gabor filter is localized by Gaussian envelope. And the good thing is about they are steerable, which is more adaptive to large tag line deformations, as you're going to see. And we published the first Gabor-Filter band in the NBS in 2003. Okay, so these are the equations. They're pretty simple equations. We just have a Gaussian modulated by sinusoid. And what you're really trying to estimate is the orientation of the Gaussian envelope. This is the Gaussian here. The orientation of the sinusoid that modulates the Gaussian. And associated with this, there are two variables, U and V, that have to do with the frequency of the sinusoid. And this is automatically obtained by finding the coordinates of the fundamental harmonic peaks in the Fourier domain. Okay, so it's simple stuff. It's nothing, it's, you know, basic graduate level classes. So the two-dimensional Gaussian scale is defined then once you know U and V. The sigma is basically in the x and y direction with these equations. And then the Gaussian orientation is again defined by this variable phi here. Okay. So what happens is that the timelines, as we said, they start parallel, but they start reorienting, changing the spacing. So we won't find these variables. Okay? So you want to find over time the new U's and V's, basically, so that you can find the new, basically, the UV is the M for to find the new spacing, and the delta phi to adapt to the variant timelines orientations. So you have to find all these parameters over time if you're going to do low level, basically, mass processing to find the timelines. So every Gabor filter in the filter bank, since, as we said, there's all these parameters, there's a bank of filters, okay, with all these different parameters. And it's convolved with the input tagged MR image, and every filter image then is tag enhanced based on specific tagging line spacing and orientation. And then you combine all the filter images, and then generate the binary image as the timeline extraction output, so like in this case. Okay, so this seems to be working pretty well because it captures actually the process of the tagging lines.
This is all 3D we're talking about here?
This 2D. Now, the 3D, you could do it. There's no reason why you couldn't do it. It's just that the spacing is too big and down information. We've tried doing that actually. And you could do it. There's nothing stopping you to do Gabor in 3D. Now, the reason why you don't need that is because we embed these timelines, as you're going to see later, in the model. So the model interpolates. Anyway, I'll have to interpolate because there's no information between the tagging plates. All the information I have is on the image. The rest has to be done by interpolation. Okay, so the hard boundary segmentation, that's the other task. Okay, once you get the timelines, and I'm going to get back to this, because with the Gabor filters, you're going to estimate the distance between them. It's very simple. But once you do that, the next step is hard boundary segmentation. So there are two methods we've tried so far. one's more the more traditional one, where for reliable and accurate tag motion extraction, first you remove the tag lines, then you apply this new method that have this Metamorphs, which, as I said, it's a hybrid between level sets of traditional boundary methods. I'll highlight it. I won't talk too many details about it. And then once you do that, then you do reconstruction. Okay, and that's how we started from this at this many years ago. And then we added all these other steps. Now, why is this difficult? Because the boundaries are very obscured and corrupted with by the nearby timelines. Don't assume that you always have nice timelines. You don't. And also, there's a lot of issues with registration of the slices that people don't talk about. So you also need some extra steps of registration of the slices. So there's a lot of details. But assuming you have well registered and you extract the timelines, then the segmentation is the next big step that I'm going to talk about. So as I said, the boundaries are the difficult issue. The tandem are tends to increase the intensity contrast between the tag and the untagged tissue, at the price, of course, of lowering the contrast between the myocardium and the blood. So again, you have all these plus and minuses, right? Try to improve one, then you lower the quality of something else. And of course, what the another problem you have is the intensity of the myocardium and the blood vary during the cardiac cycle. You don't get consistent looking blood. And you have a shorter acquisition time, high level of noise. Because, you know, if you're dealing with patients, you can't put them there for 5 hours, especially if they have a disease, they have a disease. And from clinician's point of view, what Leon wants, and I guess everybody else who's practicing, you want to have accuracy in segmentation, solely based on the MR images, which is not usually, is not always possible. Sometimes you have a big artifact, as I said. But anyway, the thing is, we want to do all this for a clinician. So as I said, there are two schemes. The first we tried is Gabor filter tagging removal technique, then the Metamorph segmentation, those papers published in 2004, and then the Gabor-based myocardial tracking method. So basically, so you can use the Gabors either to remove the tag lines, or to use the Gabors to accurately measure the spacing. The other methods that we are exploring now is learning methods, so model-based learning methods, because if you have enough samples, you'll be surprised to see with some of the methods we have, you can really, really fast do segmentation. It seems to be working very well. So this, we're still exploring what's best, and depends on the data we have, but you'll see the details. Okay, so as I said, if you want to do segmentation and reconstruction, first we want to remove the tagging lines, because we'll see, once you remove the tagging lines, then you can do, as I said, this model-based approaches to find the boundaries. Okay, so the tag removal enhances the contrast, as I said, between the myocardium and the blood pool, and helps hard boundary segmentation. How is that done? You extend the 2D Gabor filter band to the following equations by adding a phase modulation parameter, which represents the relative position of the card pixel with respect to the nearby timeline. So if you extend basically the basic equation with this modulation here, then and M is the spacing and phi is the orientation, as you can see, then tuning omega makes the enhanced region shift away from the timelines. Basically, you are trying to basically normalize the appearance of the in-between, what happens between the timelines. And therefore, the tag enhancing operation also occurs at pixels between the timelines. So basically, this is what happens. So if the tag removed image, then is the summation of the filter responses from the filter bank, basically along the timelines, and the neighboring areas between them. If you sum them up, then what you get is you get much like this. Okay. Now what you see is that all of a sudden the boundaries appear to be much more visible. Now I can apply this method that I was telling you, this Metamorphs. And why is Metamorphs as opposed to any front, if you want, kind of method? Doesn't matter if it's implicit or explicit. Is because you see the boundaries are not well defined. So I want to have a new method that takes into account both the intensity, the interior statistics, consistency of statistics, together with boundaries if they're visible. Sometimes the boundaries are not visible. And the way I can segment is based on consistency of the statistics. Okay, so this is what happens. So it came out of this necessity, basically, these Metamorphs. That's why I call them beyond shape, basically. So I don't only use shape fronts, whether it's boundary information, but I also incorporate in a statistical way inside basically texture information. And of course within a variational framework. So the way we did this One of my students, I worked with Nikos Parios when he was at Siemens, and they were computing this notion of distance transforms, right? So what happened is that if you want to have a variational approach that takes into account boundary information, but also interior statistics, how do you put apples and oranges together, right? So one way to do that is you convert your image to a distance transform, okay? Basically your boundary information. Okay, this is a boundary information approach. And you can add then a texture image. So therefore you're adding two images, that you can do. And if you put that within a variational framework, then you can minimize that, okay? Now, if this is the distance transform based on this equation, as well known, then the what minimums do, as I said, they add these two shape and appearance. And appearance could be gray level, we've extended them in other areas to texture, you know, you can do multi-scale if you want analysis of what intensity means. But in medical images, there's no such thing as Gaussian distribution, etc. So it has to be a non-parametric approach. So what we model as, you're going to see later, as the interior statistics of the intensity is based on non-parametric approach. So you embed this now into a freeform deformation grid. So as this thing basically starts there, it starts deforming based to increase the consistency of the interior statistics and any boundary information, or both. Sometimes you have one or the other. Some areas you have boundaries, some areas you don't have boundaries. Some areas you have consistent statistics, sometimes you don't. So you want to go towards a minimum that satisfies both. And the way we implement this freeform deformation is using a cubic B-spline approach. So instead of having, if you want, the boundary moving, explicitly or explicitly, we have a volume. And this volume, based on this freeform deformation, has a front. And that's the definition of the boundary. Okay? So the idea, of course, of the texture here, which is intensity in this case, has to be non-parametric. I won't assume it's Gaussian, because it's not Gaussian, the noise, or the statistics of the appearance of an image like in this case. And the probability density function starts initially. So this way, another advantage of doing this is I can start over here and then grow. So the probability density function starts like this, but changes over time. But close anyway to the initial one, because I don't want the model to start going crazy. I mean, this is a traditional problem with methods that are based on boundaries. Here the bounds are not poorly defined. So your method's going to leak if it's only based on edge-like information.
Yeah, but things like Monfort-Shah and so on use similar ideas.
They've used them. So actually, when I give the talk of my, I start with the Monfort-Shah functional. The problem is with the way that it was implemented, having outside and inside, the way it was all implemented. And there's a lot of differences.
You only have an outside and inside here?
No, there's only inside. That's it. So it's very different the way I'm doing this. On Thursday, when I give the talk, the details will be clear. But the good thing is now I can differentiate this, and together with the shaping for the boundary information, I can find pretty good minimum. Again, you have to, of course, if the boundaries and you know the initial texture is completely off, of course I'm not going to do a good segmentation. So the problems of the texture representations are like histogram, the kernel-based approximations differential with respect to model parameters, basically the shape, and they can represent arbitrary multimodal density distribution using this kernel-based method that we're using. And then we can get updated automatically when the model deforms. So basically, I don't want to pre-assume what the distribution is. I want to grow in a way that's consistent. Okay? And then you have other equations, basically, of differentiability, where you have terms dealing with the boundary information and terms with the interior texture. I won't go too much into these details because there's a lot more stuff I want to cover. But again, for these medical applications, we find that it's extremely important that you cannot use only the boundary. You have to use the interior texture and the boundary at the same time.
Can I just ask a quick question to me,
yeah.
Just to try to follow? Yeah. Is it the texture, are you filtering the tagged images and that's the texture of those?
So
isn't that going to be highly biased by wherever the tag things are showing up, and it's going to, I mean, if you can't get them out completely?
I can use it two ways, actually. Either, because this is a texture-based method, if I have a heart here, and I have the timelines, I can impose a texture in the Metamask, right? I don't, it's not only intensity-based. So we've used it actually on the Roymontes. It's just that when the timelines are pretty good, it's best to remove them and then do a pretty good estimate using the Metamask, and then using that estimate actually go back to the tagging line, to the original images.
Okay. But I mean, you're trying to do priors on the appearances? Or
no, 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 nothing. Right. No, no, no. I could do, and I've it's another paper at Mikai where you could do priors, but not for this. You know, the problem is with these priors, the scanner, the way you tune it, every time is different. Yeah. So these priors, now you can do priors on the shape, though. Yeah. You don't have to do priors on the appearance, because the Metamask, you're allowed to do two types of priors, intensity, basically texture, or boundaries. So you can do the boundary, because the heart doesn't change. But then again, it's another question. I've been talking this about with Leon about this. It's like, sometimes you have abnormalities. You don't want your prior to bias you. So an analogy we've been doing, we have a real-time system for face tracking. So somebody sits in a chair. This is used for homeland security application. So I can track in real time the face with no markers, nothing. And how we did this with a combination of learning, again, and traditional visual methods. And what really happens in terms of how much priors you want to put that, there's a very fine line between switching between priors. How do I detect that I'm turning 90 degrees as opposed to frontal face? You can use the same prior. So the same thing, the analogy in the heart is that you have to detect somehow there's an abnormality and then use the right prior. You can use the same prior for normals on abnormal hearts, then you cannot get the wrong results. So the good thing about it is that I don't need to learn prior. There's no priors. So I just started there. And usually, because in the scanner you know that the heart is approximately in the middle, it's very hard to start. The mic starts somewhere in the middle, then it grows. So, just to give you the example of what I've been talking, this is what the Metamask give you. And this is the LV and the RV in this case. Now, once you get the boundaries, this is again a step between before the 3D reconstruction, then what you have to do is, I want to also track the timelines, because the timelines is actually the information about what the walls are doing. This is the ground truth, okay? So if you want to do that, as I said, with the previous methods, now I want to track the fibers, use the Gabor information with these parameters, the M, the delta phi, and the omega, basically the spacing, the angle, and the phase, to find the barns, to find where they are, etc. So at every pixel, the Gabor filter mag is applied, and the parameter values are found to be the one maximizing the Gabor filter response. And this is what happens. So the optimal parameter values at each pixel make up for the three parameter maps that tell the region properties around its surface. So the original image, the dark spacing map, the orientation of the face. These three parameters that I told you about. Now, oops. So this is another example. So parallel tuning in the real MR image. This is the phase map. And the spacing is based on the original distance, which is, we know how it is, because we know how to pose the timelines, and divided by this M parameter here.
Go to a full screen.
Sorry?
I'm going to go to a full screen mode for your...
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Unless you want to edit it.
It works. This works. Okay, so far what I've talked about is I've talked the problem of this is the RV here. Okay, so you have tagging lines. So I've talked about two methods, right? I want to segment the boundaries, and then in order to do that, the one approach we've taken is remove the tagging lines, find the boundaries using Metamask, which do shape and texture, and then track the tagging lines, so that I can find the spacing. Okay, this gives me enough information because I have it on a slice-to-slice basis. These are many slices, right? So how now for your metric representation, where I can do reconstruction? Another method we're trying, because of all these many steps here, you know, there's tagging lines, there's metamorphosis. Another way is, what if I have the original images and I had some priors, basically, had some priors about the appearance. This keeps going on basically about what happens in a case like this. Eventually, what I can do in 2D is I can do a very, very dense, if you want, reconstruction of the movement of the walls in 2D. And the same thing then, of course, happens in 3D by interpolation. Okay, so this is by doing this first approach. Another approach you can do, afterwards, I'm running a little bit faster. So once you do that, the way we continue that doing things in 3D is like, you start from the middle of the cycle of the heart during systole. The reason why this works is because from around the middle you have still pretty good tags. So the middle keyframe in the middle of the cycle. So you can go up and down to do the rest of the slices, and then back and forward towards over time. Okay, so you can do now the segmentation, right? You're talking about the whole cycle, right? Just to give you one instance, right? But if you want to do it in a system, we have a system called CardView, that what you do is you input the whole volume, right? So somehow you start from somewhere. Usually we start from the middle in terms of time and space. And then you go up and down, and left to right, time-wise. So you can use now priors from what you've segmented in the middle slice to bias you towards segmenting left, right, and up and down, which makes sense. The heart doesn't change that much from slice to slice. So use the previous solution to go to the next, okay? So we found over the years that this kind of methods work. Because if you start doing it for every slice without any knowledge, that takes a lot more time. So why do that? If you can start from one slice, do it well. Usually the middle one is pretty robust and looks pretty good in terms of appearance. And then go, as I said, up and down, left to right, okay? So here's some results we're getting. So of course here it doesn't mean anything, the tagging lines, but it's in between that matters. And these are segmentations of the LV, the RV. Now one thing that you have to notice, okay, you're dealing with MR. You cannot, it's very difficult, as Leon said, to get the contours. I mean, we get something about the contours, but you have to understand, is the papillary muscle part of it, or is it not part of it? There are a lot of details in here that, you know, we're missing. Also, the resolution is not there to find the undulations in the inner wall, which means you have to use CT if you want to do that, and combine it with MR. The LV is a complicated issue because, or the RV, sorry, the right ventricle, because right now when you see the middle cross section, you see it as in a kind of a bent ellipsoid, but when you go up towards the base, then you see two circles. Because they outflow in the inflow track. I'll show you some real anatomy later on. So you have to be able to deal with all this, and metamorphs, of course, can do that, and change topology, etc., that you need if you want to do segmentation. Because all of a sudden, from one object, you're going to get two, from one slice to the next, because of the outflow tracks. So we get pretty good now in between the timelines. Now, there's all sorts of issues with tagging lines that sometimes they flip, you know, what you think, you know, over time, this corresponds to, you know, over time, then they might flip, because as the heart contracts, you're having a subset of the original tagging lines being part of the heart walls. So you need to be able to do all this, the management of tracking the tagging lines pretty good. So without boundaries, you cannot do it. You don't know where the heart is. So, all I'm saying is, looks like we're getting good progress, but haven't solved the problem completely. That's why, I'll show you some more. This is a normal heart, short axis, long axis. Now, long axis is another story again. How much can you see the timeline? This is the timelines we have, right? They're not great, but that's the reality. This is diseased heart, so you see it's not beating very rigorously. So one, of course, set of problems could be is if I just did 2D, that's good enough, because for a lot of cardiologists and radiologists, just practicing 2D. Okay, so even getting robustness at the 2D level is pretty much a progress. But you know, want to study eventually how the heart works from a scientific point of view, but eventually if you really do the full 3D analysis, you will be able to find correlations that we don't understand, and we don't know. So that's why I want to go into the 3D, of course. So the other segmentation, because sometimes you see this pretty fuzziness, and we found that sometimes going through all these metamorphs could be expensive. Sometimes we try another approach. I'm not telling you one is better than the other, just give you another example. That you can do boundary segmentation based on learning methods. And what do you mean by learning methods? So sometimes the boundary is very blurred in filtering methods, like really the timelines, you can't see them. The epicardium is difficult to be separated from the nearby organs, no shape priors. And then for accurate segmentation, manual interaction is needed. Now, in all these schemes and over the years, given how the data look, don't exclude that, don't think that you're going to get a completely automated method. Sometimes you want to get good enough and let the radiologist, the cardiologist, correct it. Okay? So we don't necessarily, and I think it's a mistake to think, unless the scanners get so good and you get such great data, that you're going to be able to get completely automatic segmentation. So giving tools that after you've gone close enough to the solution, that could be also a big success. So we're trying to do, again, a fully automatic, not fully automatic, as I said, depending on the end result, but fully automatic in terms of learning to detect and localize the hardest initialization of the segmentation and learn a shape prior model via active shape model. So it's not so much appearance, as you're going to see, but shape. And I'll show you the whole spectrum of how we do that, that we published at SCV. And then you want to learn confidence-rated appearance features to direct the segmentation. So it's based, this method, on an adaptation of Alcuin by Viola and using Arabus. So you know Arabus is a pretty good classification algorithm. There are, of course, past Arabus methods. But what it does is selects a small number of important features from a huge potential feature set, that is weak classifiers, and then creates a weighted combination of them to use as an accurate strong classifier. So during the boosting process, then every iteration selects one feature from the total potential features, these weak classifiers, and combines it with the existing classifier that was obtained in the previous iterations. So basically, what we mean by weak classifiers, you use hard wavelets for the boundaries of the heart, okay? And then what we're trying to find through the examples, the learning phase, to find the best combination, if you want, of these that separate the walls from the outside or the inside. So you can have now training data. Again, you have to be careful now, because the caveat of the other method is that you don't assume anything, and using the metamorphs, the model expands. But if your data are terrible, you're not going to do well. This depends on training data. So that's another, this class of image processing methods, if you don't have good training data, you're not going to do well. Okay, so you have to have seen enough, basically boundaries. And then once you've done that, the detection result is useful as initialization for the following segmentation. Basically, we can automatically now find where the heart is and do boundary segmentation very fast. Okay, but again, assumes it depends on the priors, basically the boundaries we've seen. We have to have seen enough examples of boundaries. This is not for type tracking. This is for boundaries. And so the active shape model approach, basically, was done by Kutz and Taylor, and we've adapted it here for this problem. Is that the shape of the mid portion of the heart in short axis is consistent and topologically fixed, as we said. That is pretty. This looks pretty much the same. And the heart shape is represented by a set of contours which consist of 50 landmark points, so around the contour. And the landmark make up of an ordered shape vector. And then by principal component analysis, if the training set is large enough, any hard shape can be approximately modeled by this. Now, it's a linear method. You know, in other types of research, we've used nonlinear methods, but the heart doesn't really change that much. So a linear approximation is pretty good. So you have the mean shape, and then the matrix of shape variations, and B is the vector of shape parameters weighting the shape variations. So it's pretty standard. So in the local appearance modeling, basically, as we said, we want to find these statistics here. We need image forces that are more accurate. Okay, so we won't have conventional edge or region-based image forces have limitations, as we said, because of the complicated boundary region appearance in tandem MRI. So we need to use all possible information, such as edges, ridges, tagging line, breaking points, to form a complex world. So basically, how are you going to apply this Larry method? What are your features? There's always something that you all face in any image processing method you do. What is your feature? If your features are wrong, your segmentation will be wrong. So at different locations on the boundary, the rule must be different. And the confidence should be different. So here versus here should be different. Okay. So it's a learning, but model-based learning method. Because I know that it's a hard. I'll have to use different learning and different features depending where I am. Okay, otherwise it won't work. You can't use everywhere the same.
For every orientation, right?
Sorry?
For every orientation it's different.
Yes. So that's why I'm gonna talk about it. So the weak classifier, so to design the local appearance characteristics, we design three different kinds of steerable filters. So derivatives of a two-dimensional Gaussian to capture the edges. Looks like this. Again, simple. Edges. Second order derivatives of a 2D Gaussian to capture the ridges. And then half reverse two dimensional Gabor filters to capture the tagging line breakpoints. So, like this. Now, these features we found to work pretty well. Now, at the training image, the first is scaled and rotated the same size of orientation. Something about learning, right? When I give you images, there's a registration problem. I'm not going to talk about it, how you do it automatically, but you have to register the images. And then at every landmark point of the contours, a small window around it is cut out as a positive training sample for this particular landmark point. Now, along the normal of the contour, on each side of the point, then we cut out two windows as negative appearance training samples for this particular landmark point. Now, here's the trick. It's different, the learning that you do on the epicardium, different on the septum, different on the RVM. Okay? So you have to be careful when you apply this method. And so there's some confidence rate here about details on the other boost. And this is a probability. In the end, you get some probability about where the boundary is. So at the selected landmark point on the same models, we search along the normal of the contour on both sides to find a point that has the highest probability of being the boundary. That's how this thing works. So the image force should push the current landmark point to the new position, and we set the image force as like this. So again, it's a model-based learning method. So you see there's a model of a heart and gets deformed to fit using this method. So let me show you how this thing works. So you automatically find approximately and then does this. Okay. So it's very fast, and you know, in cases like this where you can't see boundaries, I mean, if you try to use traditional segmentation methods, it won't work. So you have a shape prior, and together with the boundaries, we find these methods work pretty well. We have a lot of hope in making this kind of methods. There's some more segmentation results. Now, this is also a version which only talks about space learning. There's also space-time extension of this we're working on. Because the height's not static, it's dynamic. Let me give you some examples here. So this is some segmentation of short axis. This is with his learning methods, very fast. You see, the boundaries are not good, the images are not good. That's the images you're gonna typically get. Now if you have the boundaries, it's very easy to do Gabor filtering here. And know what you're doing. Okay, so I gave you two examples of low-level image processing. This is stuff we've done many years ago. And we're now changing, but I'll give you probably all the results here. But again, now that I have the boundaries, I have the tagging lines, the question becomes now how do I do reliable 3D estimation of the movement of the heart? And how, of course, you validate. Now, the good thing is why we did the timelines. Unfortunately, Leon was at Penn at the time. But if you want to validate, you know, you have validation. You know the timelines. This is ground truth. So you don't need phantoms, even though we used in the past phantoms. But I'll talk about the validation here. But the question becomes, okay, how do you reconstruct the heart? So here's a cross-section of the LV. As I said, as you see in MR, you don't see any of this. You see the papillary muscles that an expert like Leon knows where it is, but to me, I had a hard time in the beginning still to understand where the papillary muscle is. But let's say we cut it out. Okay, there's another level of research if you want to study the papillary muscle. But let's say you want to do this, you get the LV, because that's where primarily the disease in adults is. But you also want to have a combined mold of LV and RV, and this is a cross-section of the RV. So as I told you, the difficulty is with the RV is that you get cross-sections, let's say like this, all of a sudden you get one circle here, another circle here. These are the two outflow tracks. So as the previous speakers have said, blood from the brain and the lower body go to the atrium, then to the right ventricle, then to the lungs, and then go back from the lungs to the left ventricle, right? So disease in kids, in Children's Hospital in Philadelphia and at Harvard, where one of our students is, Edith Haber, who did all this work at the RV at the time, happens here. So you may want to study hypertrophy or other types of disease. So it's not that it's useless, the RV. You want it because it's also, as Leon knows, has told us, sometimes you have a disease on the RV, what's the impact on the LV? So the septum, et cetera. So there's all these things that we want to study that we don't know about, okay? And only a 3D model will let you know, because people say, okay, if you just see the ejection fraction, what is this, if it's bad, let's say under 60%, what's the cause of it? Is this an infraction here, And what's the correlation, if you want to find more correlation between survivability and low ejection fraction and infraction here as opposed to here, for example? There's so many questions that the doctors can then do large-scale studies that they can study. So that's why I think it's important. Assuming, of course, that our analysis is reliable. So the problem in 3D becomes like this. So you have image planes stacked. Normal to them, initially, you have these time planes. The way they are manifested is, of course, as 2D, because that's the information you have. You have these lines in short axis and long axis. And the physics of the tagging planes is that if you see this tagging line, mathematically, it only gives me a constraint normal to the original line, okay? So I'm losing, it's like optical flow, I'm losing the through plane motion. I'm only having one component. So each tagging line gives you one component of the motion. The motion is three-dimensional. You need three sets of orthogonal tagging lines, okay, to be able to do reconstruction. So, as I said, with Gabors, et cetera, I have the timelines, I have the boundaries, and if I have that, then I can do reconstruction. Again, it's not as easy as it sounds, because now I have to have a model. So I have to have a model of the heart, here, the LV and the RV. Let's say RV here, LV here. And I have to mesh it. I may have errors because of the meshing. So there's lots of details here again. But that's the information I have. And everything else between the timelines is going to be interpolation. Okay? But the ground truth is the timelines. So this is what happens. The initial plane becomes a surface, deforms. So I need to be able to track. So I have to embed it in finite elements. They usually are C1, so I can get these deformations pretty well. Or if it's C0 for speed, then I have to use more finite elements. So as I said, you need three sets of orthogonal tagging lines, like in this case. That's an example. Sometimes they do cylindrical. Leon has been doing a lot of different ways of doing tagging. So, but I need these three independent coordinates, if you want, to do the reconstruction. So this is another case where you have two sets of orthogonal tagging lines in the short axis and one in the long axis. Again, Leon got this data. But you see, of course, they're bad. That's why the schematization is difficult. But you see they fade, right? One way to do that, as long as the patient It's okay, as, you, as I said, you can cascade, basically reinsert them since you're gating the heart, assuming it's normal, the gate, the beating is normal. It is periodic. So the 3D, you can analyze as this. You have image acquisition, the segmentation, the time tracking that we talked about, the finite element mesh generation. I mean, the many experts here, but we have some methods. The 3D motion reconstruction, the analysis and the validation. That's extremely important. But with timelines, we're fortunate, because as I said, timelines are the ground truth. So you know the timelines on your model if they coincide with the real timelines. So this is an example. We have these elements. There are many other elements. Alistair has other types, has used many other types. Again, you don't want to go crazy with finite elements because you want speed. And remember, the information is only the timelines. The rest is interpolation. So you can do the most fancy finite elements. So what? The reality is that the information is in the timelines. As long as your method doesn't screw up the interpolation, you can do pretty well with C1 or even C0 interpolation. So the typical form models is the ones I've been doing many years. So you have the Lagrange equation of motion. Q here is a vector, velocities and position. And you have external and internal forces. So again, finite element methods here. So what you do is, as I said, you have to register. When you make the method, you have to register the timing planes and the timelines. So they become virtual timelines in your model. And the data come in the real timelines, and the combination of contours and timelines give you the deformation. And this is what happens, basically. Your timing plane becomes a seat in 3D. This is another example, but I want to show you in terms of validation now. I'll show you afterwards some more results. Dr. Chui talked yesterday about motion simulators, but in this case, we find that this is a pretty good validation in vivo because I have the timelines. I mean, how much more can I get? Why do I need a virtual simulator? But Leon had built all these phantoms, and you can image them, so you can do a lot of things also. But the real thing is that you have the real data, and they're validatable. So that's why I think you can get, that's why it's good that we're working with this MR and tagging, because at least the biggest question that all of you have, including cardiologists and radiologists, is what's a normal heartbeat? Who knows that? Nobody. There's no statistics about normal heartbeat. So you may have to get a database, in my opinion, about using this method, which is the ground truth, regardless of what you use clinically. You can use echo, whatever you want. But to get the ground truth of what is a normal heartbeat, what happens in disease, etc., I think you need this kind of data to do at least validation in vivo, which is good. So in terms of the analysis, I'll give you some examples on RVH, 5 normals and 4 RVH patients. This disease manifested by lack of twisting, not so much twisting in normal, but a lot more twisting in patients. And you can measure this angle between the local circumferential direction, basically, how much this is going off, which is manifested with the twisting, or the principal strain. And one way, I mean, that's another issue, big issue here, about how do you present results. I mean, the doctors talked before, and they said, okay, how do you present results to a doctor? I mean, these are not mathematicians where you tell them every point here on this node moves up and down. Well, that's useless, right? So you have to, now from all these 1 million parameters here, you're going to have to summarize them, okay? So that's why, as I said, we need a lot of examples to see, quantify what's normal, then put a number, put an arrow that somebody else showed in the talk. So what we did at the time, we said, okay, here's the base, the mid-ventricle, and the apex. Let's say we do this crude analysis and see what's the difference. Or this is how I could summarize the results. But again, the visualization of, we don't have anybody visualization, but this is something we're going to face. Right? How are we going to present all these results? In what coordinate system? Is it a global coordinate system? Is it a local? Sometimes you may want both. I mean, Leon, at least, would need that. So this is another area of research. Eventually, once all these things work, you're going to have to face how you present the results to the doctor. So anyway, these are some segmentation. This is some of the what we've done in the past about normals, for example. And then some displacements of the inner wall that Nemo showed. And this is the principal strains that look more downwards. You can get in normals basically this parameter, the free wall and the septum. Of course, there's a difference. The septum is more constrained, the free wall moves a little bit more. That's why you see the blue lights having. These are average results, but the base, the mid, and the apex. And now this is the rotational angle. Again, the free wall always rotates more than the septum. In the RVH, like in this case, you see these arrows, the principal strains, being more circumference and not so much downwards. The heart doesn't contract as much. I mean, hopefully, when all this thing becomes clinically useful, then immediately a doctor will see the area that has a problem. Because not the whole heart may have a problem, it could be a regional, especially at the beginning of a disease. So hopefully you can catch the disease earlier. That's another benefit, we hope. And when it comes to normal versus RVH, you see mainly the difference between base, middle, and apex in terms of the free wall. It doesn't rotate as much. It doesn't contract as much. And the same thing with this angle, the free wall angle. So, again, so as I said, the next type of research is 3D reconstruction. So it can be used to collect RV or LV, including timing differences. The more spatial resolution or time resolution they get in the MR, then you can see all these phenomena that were discussed by previous speakers. Now, the contraction can be correlated with fiber angles. I'll talk about the next is about fiber angles. I have like 10 minutes. 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. So once you do, this is all strain analysis, and you can do all sorts of studies, right? That everybody has talked about that they need. Now, the next task is the stress strain, okay, and fiber orientation. So to do that, why we do that, I don't know how clinically yet it's gonna be useful, but in terms of understanding why the heart beats, I think it is important. Now the problem, as everybody said, that you cannot measure the stresses directly. There's a complex structure in motion and an analytic solution is impossible. You don't know the stress strain relationship. And of course, you know, if you do that, then you can provide basic physiological and pathophysiological mechanisms. Now we had a student who just graduated over the last 4 years, and we tried this, and this is stuff we still want to pursue. So how do you estimate the stress and the strains in a way that makes sense, if you will, in a patient specific way? So you can use, the idea is this, you use the 3D strain data to optimize fiber and seed angles. Kevin Costa has done similar work in terms of the seed, the fibers, so we have a different method. And he was also the Excel student here. And then you can use the strain, ventricular structure, tissue testing data, and boundary conditions to estimate material properties and active stress. So basically, you want to have some statistical methods, assuming you know approximately what's going on, to tune it to this particular patient. And the way you can validate it is this. Then you can put the stresses you found and see, do you get the strains that the timelines basically predict? That's how you can validate. Like, if my forces were correct, then if I put the forces in my model, I should be able to get the strains. Remember, it's a nonlinear problem. Therefore, if you put the forces, the fact that your optimization gives you some forces may not give you the if you do it the other way around, the right strains. So you can go into get stuck in a local minimum, basically. So anything we do here is a problem of nonlinear optimization. So research, I think, in this area, I think, is extremely important. So the hypothesis that the fiber strain is as homogeneous as possible, assuming that's what everybody else assumes. We want to embed fibers and optimize them in a model in a way that the fiber, as you know, changes as you go from the outer to the inner wall, basically, the rotation like this, so that the wall can thicken. Okay, so we've got this this kind of equations that are in the literature, but we'll optimize those. Okay, the way, as I said, cost analysis. And if you embed this in a supermetric element, you embed them in your finite elements, and then, assuming this notion of strain, uniform strain, then you can basically have an algorithm where you can update the fiber angle to achieve this. So anyway, you put the tensor information to compute the strain component along each fiber, and you want to minimize the strains. Okay? And this is something, you know, a lot of other people have done. It's not new. And if you minimize the strains, we have our own method to do that. But once you minimize, then you kind of get an approximation of what the fiber should be for this particular person. And this is basically what you want to get. Basically, you want to get fibers that start like this and orient differently, approximately 60 degrees. Once you do that, okay, this is the best we can do. Remember, in the absence of DTI or other methods, we can't do anything else. So assuming that now, the hope is that now I have a finite element mesh, I have the fibers, the activations along the fibers. Again, I have to assume some values here about the activation, and I have to solve basically a nonlinear problem, basically an optimization problem, which is based on boundary conditions, pressures. You know, the heart is under pressure from the blood pool. There's a null force generated from fiber force. You will do some single value composition. I'll explain later. There's some assumption on the stiffness, and then and a nonlinear optimization method based on expectation maximization. Once and we can do it for the cardiac cycle that you've seen before here. So we don't have atrium data yet. We assume springs connect from above with the ventricular wall, because anyway the atria are connected, so we have to cut it and do that. So the apex moves little during systole. Assume it takes given displacements. The assumption, of course, that the muscle generates force along the fiber rotations. That's not incorrect. And then use force balance to calculate the equivalent model forces from fiber force. This is an example of a model force. So we use experimental passive Young moduli to the reconstructed strain data. That's your input. And then you do singular value decomposition and expectation maximization to optimize between the strain, the material properties, the stiffness matrix, and the stresses. So let me show you basically what this is. So if this is like solve it on a step-by-step as a static problem, then you have the pressure in the cavity, you have the active forces along the fibers, you don't know those, you know approximately those, you know approximately the stiffness, and you know the strains. So you want to do expectation maximization between K and F. Okay? Now you understand if you go far away from where K is or F, then you're going to get stuck in a local minimum. But as I said, the only way to validate this is then once I assume I know K and I found F, then I'm going to put F and see if I can get A. Okay? So I won't go through the expectation maximization approach here, but I mean, assume you know that. But I just want to show you some stuff we did here. So if you get start from the strains, and then you embed the fibers, and the initial fiber orientation, which is, as I said, optimized by this method, and then you start outputting strains, stresses, etc. So this is ongoing work. I mean, as I said, there's a lot of issues here. By no means we've solved the problem, but I think it's very interesting. If we understand why the heart beats, then I think eventually we'll understand better the consequences of dysfunction of the heart. So this is strange, etc. There's a lot of anyway. And of course, the last thing I said, we did the first attempt in '98. I mean, you know, Peskin has started many years ago, but Peskin tries to simulate everything without any real variable. Basically, everything's embedded in the water, etc. The approach we're taking is this. Assuming I now have the strings, right? I have the way the wall beats. Of course, not accurately, but approximately enough. Then, using a method which is a combination of Aristotle and Levinson that we all use students, Sussman, who adapt some of the methods, then we can get some simulations. This one, unfortunately, I just got it yesterday, but he didn't get the visualization here, right? So this is Renman. So take away this, but intuitively, it works well in the sense that sucking blood this way comes out this way. Just this is residual that you can get rid of for this. By Thursday, I'll get better results. But you can do pretty well now with this method. So basically, the next step is, okay, something doesn't beat properly. What's the effect on the flow? Okay, so hopefully by Mika I'll have better things to show and some validation. Because now you can validate, as you see here, with what Leon said about MR phase contrast imaging. So you can validate basically how well your velocities are doing. Or you can use some of these velocities to help you in our Stokes equations. We haven't done anything more in terms of electrophysiology that others people have talked about, but the more you have models that are reliable and Bayesian specific, then of course you understand you can do a lot more things. But it's still a very challenging problem. I haven't solved it, and I think it's a very exciting area.